This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
As any intentional act. And the Buddha breaks down four different kinds of karma. We have the bright karma, the dark karma, the bright and dark karma, and then the neither dark nor bright karma. Of course, the bright karma, we're talking about uplifting good deeds, good acts. The dark karma would be bad acts, bright and dark karma, a mixture of both. And then I was really intrigued by the neither dark nor bright karma, this volition to abandon karma. So I was thinking about acts that bring about neither dark nor bright karma. And of course, you've got these eight right here in the Eightfold Path. I'm going to try to minimize my, there we go. So I wanted to focus on the right view, because right view apparently focuses on either mundane bright karma or super mundane neither bright nor dark karma. Well, what's right view? I take it to mean really being present in the moment and really questioning, asking, being present with the question, what is this moment asking of me right now? So as an example of this is on page 179, the Buddha is talking with Anapanasatipatthika. I butchered that, sorry. It would be even more, he's going on and talking about these good deeds and, you know, these like what, 80,000 gold bowls and then silver bowls in the bowls and food. And he's going on and talking about how each deed is better than the other. And the Buddha says it would be even more fruitful still if one would develop the perception of impermanence just for the time it takes to snap one's fingers. And I was thinking that that's an example of a super mundane right view. Insight surpasses all. That's the name of the subheading of that final section. So was also thinking about rebirth and karma and karma as it's attached to rebirth. And we've got these good deeds, this bright karma in the mundane world that results in upward movement in one of six different realms, from the really bad hellish realms to the really good heavenly realms. And it made me really think of, all right, so what's being reborn here into these different realms? Well, if we are to understand that sentient beings are composed of five aggregates, matter, sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. And if we're to understand that sentient beings are not awakened, although contain Buddha nature, they still have attachments. And if a sentient being is composed of these five aggregates, there's no really fundamental, unending, eternal essence to us, to people, to any sentient being. They themselves are just an aggregate of these different composite forms, these different things. So what does it mean to be awakened then? Okay, well, if it means to be beyond being a sentient being with attachments, and each sentient being is composed of these five aggregates, each of those aggregates acting towards attachment or clinging, bringing in brighter, dark karma, that's a consideration, as well as to be awakened is to be beyond death and rebirth, to be beyond the dance of karma. So this led me to think of rebirth as simply the dance of karma, that this is just cause and effect, intentional acts, bringing about other intentional acts, and beings that they're just composed of these aggregates, they themselves are really in this dance of karma. So I'm not really, it's kind of weird now that I can't see anybody's faces here. I'm just talking to a PowerPoint. Interesting. It really got me to thinking about rebirth. And as I was talking with my partner, when we met to discuss this, the idea of being reborn in a different, it's some different realm in the future is really an alien concept to me. I really, you know, I struggle to even hold on to a sense of self that is going to be reborn. And I'm oftentimes confused as to what is being reborn. The best I understand it to be is that rebirth itself is simply karma playing out, this this dance of cause and effect and intentional acts in the world. So my I guess best understanding of rebirth is that it occurs every moment, as does death. It's just constantly arising and ceasing, this sense of self. Everything is changed and impermanent. That then led me to really, it's hard for me to conceptualize these six realms as being actual realms that some aggregate form known as me is going to go to after my bodily death. But I think that these six realms are very present in the here and now. I think that I see them best as metaphors for different mental states in the world today. And then it's the human realm, middle path, right? It's not an extreme realm where we can transcend the cycle of death and rebirth by becoming awake, awakened, thus leading us to be fully present, embrace right view, be insightful, and ask sincerely and fully, what is this moment asking of me? So I really struggled with a lot of this. It's hard for me to take anything literally. So I was seeing this metaphorically. So anyhow, I want to move on and invite my partner to speak up.
Thank you, partner. I'm happy to continue our presentation. When I first got the notice of this assignment on this chapter, to this chapter, I found myself really averse. In fact, the thought occurred to me, I must have committed some terrible, cruel infraction in a previous life to have been assigned this chapter. Because of all the chapters, this is the one that I really did not want to have anything to do with. But this isn't the first time that I have been averse to dealing with the Buddha's Dharma. There have been many, many situations and aspects of the teachings that I struggle with and don't understand and don't want anything to do with. So typically what I do when I sort of bump up against a teaching or part of a teaching that is troublesome to me and can be troublesome in many different ways, instead of just kind of fighting with it and insisting that I stay with it until I really unravel it and get it clear, my tendency is to just kind of set it aside, not to necessarily engage with it in some sort of a battle between it and my brain, but to sort of leave the door open to being instructed, you might say, not to try to figure it out myself, but to set it aside with an open mind and just address the issues that are alive for me at the time, the stuff that I'm really grappling with that really touched my life. And then with that confidence or faith that at some future moment, some future place, something will appear, some insight will appear if I keep practicing and keep studying and keep discussing these things with others, that something will visit me and it will help. So I wasn't quite able to set this aside because I was assigned, and this was something I had to address. But I tried to take an attitude of questioning about this. And so one of the things I decided to do was not to take the presentation of karma or kama just as a surface teaching, and just to kind of look a little more deeply into it, to kind of break it up into its elements and see what that revealed. So I kind of divided this into three kinds of questioning segments. And the first was just looking at karma, as we know, means action, just as a kind of a neutral, that's what's the word means, presumably, just action. And I was thinking about that just as a kind of wind. You know, wind is just action of air. It's a kind of neutral thing, movement. However, according to the teachings, this is not just action, this is volitional action. So what does that mean? It means perhaps, to take this metaphor, that we deliberately create air. There's an element of making it happen, making air happen, like turning on a fan, turning on a windmill, you know, that there's a volition involved in that activity. And then beyond that, there is a judgment, as we saw, bright or dark. And of course, I have questions about how that differs, if at all, from good and bad. Is bright the same as good? It has a different connotation. But in any case, there's a judgment attached to this volitional action. So for example, if we took the volitional action of turning on a fan, we could say that if we turned on a windmill making wind, but that windmill was killing birds, then we might make a judgment about that volitional action. So it seems as if when we connect karma with rebirth, there is a judgment involved. Good or bad, bright or dark. So kind of leaving it at that, kind of teasing out some of these elements in karma. So if those three elements are involved in karma, what does that presuppose? If those three elements are involved in karma, as essentially involved, the first thing is that it indicates that, in fact, we can decide, we can make a decision. And that raises the question of, who is this I that makes the decision? And what does a decision mean? What is a volition? And is there a self or a being that makes that decision? So that's another question. Implicit in karma is the connection between intention and action. And often karma is described as something that's more significantly involved with one's intention than the actual action that results from it. So my question here is, there's a wonderful little image about a monk riding on a horse, and he's asked by an observer, "Where are you going?" And the monk says, "Ask the horse." So the question here is, we often have intentions, but to what degree is that intention connected with our action? How much agency do we have in connecting our intentions with our actions? Or are we just kind of carried along by the horse of life? So that's another question that I'd like to raise. And then, of course, the judgment aspect of this, that one can really discern what is bright and what is dark. And here I'm reminded of the story, I'm sure some of you know this story, of the farmer who gets a bunch of wild horses as a gift, and his neighbor comes by and says, "Oh, how wonderful, you know, what a great gift." And the farmer says, "Maybe." And then one of the horses runs into his son and breaks his leg, and the neighbor comes over and says, "Oh, isn't that terrible? You know, that's a tragedy." And the farmer says, "Maybe." And the sequence of events proceeds. The son is, because of the broken leg, is exempt from military service. And then the neighbor comes and says, "Oh, that's great." So it's dark light, dark light. Where do we stop? And how do we discern what is dark and what is bright? And then finally, is there a link between intention, volition, action, and consequence? And it seems as if karma does involve a link between those elements, those events. And so I want to question that. I want to question whether that link is viable. And I'm going to introduce some alternatives to that kind of connection that is essential to karma and then finally results in a certain kind of rebirth. So the first alternative is something that I think is beautifully expressed, and I recommend this essay highly, and it's called The Ethics of Elfland by G.K. Chesterton. And in it, he speaks about the difference between fairy tales and physical facts, science, between fairy tales and science. And he says, "We have always in our fairy tales kept a sharp distinction between the science of mental relations, in which there really are laws, and the science of physical facts, in which there are no laws, but only weird repetitions." So I think here, and I'm going to read a little bit more about what he says. "We cannot say why an egg can turn into a chicken any more than we can say why a bear could turn into a fairy prince. As ideas, the egg and the chicken are further off from each other than the bear and the prince. For no egg in itself suggests a chicken, whereas some princes do suggest bears. Granted then that certain transformations do happen, it is essential that we should regard them as fairy tales, not in the unphilosophic manner of science and the laws of nature. When we are asked why eggs turn to birds or fruits fall in autumn, we must answer exactly as the fairy godmother would answer if Cinderella asked her why mice turn to horses or her clothes fell from her at 12 o'clock. We must answer that it is magic. It is not a law, for we do not understand its general formula." So we tend to regard karma as a law, the law of cause and effect. And what Chesterton is suggesting here, and I think Dogen also suggests this, and even using the metaphor also of a film strip, there is a discontinuous identity between events, that we do not know how one thing turns into another thing. It's not a law, because a law is something that we, it's a kind of tautology. It's necessary. A law is that something happens and it necessarily causes the next thing. Karma is not that. There's no necessity between a cause and an effect. And so Dogen talks about this when he speaks about firewood becoming ash, that there's no intrinsic connection between firewood and ash. We do not see how that actually happens. And similarly with the film strip, each frame is a stillness. It's complete in and of itself. And yet when it's repeated, we have the illusion that there's a continuity there. So what I'm calling into question here is the lawfulness of karma, the necessary connection between our acts and the consequences of those acts. So that's just another question that I'm raising. So you can go to the next slide. Okay. I'm also now revisiting the whole notion of rebirth. And obviously, this chapter is about the connection between karma and rebirth. Now, if we understand that if we accept what I've just been suggesting, that there is a thoroughly neutral karma, it's just activity, just action. If karma is viewed not as cause and effect, as in fact causally disconnected from consequences, that each act has its own integrity, that we cannot discover any intrinsic law in the relationship between cause and effect, then what significance could rebirth have if it's not really fundamentally connected or intrinsically connected with our actions? And so I'm suggesting that maybe rebirth is a way of describing life. That's one of its functions. It's to be taken metaphorically, or maybe even literally, that we are born and die, born and die, born and die continuously. So it's just a vocabulary that we use. We take it to be metaphorical, and it's just a way of picturing what our life is, impermanence. It also can serve as introducing morality in our life. But we have to accept this morality, this good and bad, as a creation. It doesn't have any intrinsic, it doesn't have any intrinsic reality. There's no absolute good or bad, bright or dark. In fact, I think bright and dark may be a much better way of talking about karma. So I'm happy to explore that. We have this, somehow human beings have this drive to to have a moral law, justice, or have accountability, that somehow our actions have purchase, that we can make judgments about them. And so rebirth has a place in order in introducing morality into our lives. Yeah. Without it, we may not, you know, we may not take morality that seriously. And the last thing I want to say is this, I think what is really most significant to me, and that is this insight that I had that visited me that I wasn't looking for. And it had to do with a visit by my daughter, Amy. That's why Amy is listed along with Socrates and Keats. I don't mean she has the same status as any of those, but she brought me a teaching. And usually when she visits, she lives in California, and she usually visits once or twice a year. And I take her to the airport and kiss her goodbye. And I get back into the car, and then I completely lose it. I just start sobbing and, you know, just feeling completely sad and having lost something. And this particular visit this year, she departed, and I got back into my car, and I did not have that same feeling. In fact, I felt quite calm, and I even smiled, which would be very unusual at her departure. And I was very puzzled by this, why I wasn't crying. I mean, it was definitely that she wasn't going to see me for quite a while. And I sort of stayed with that puzzlement for a couple of days. And then it dawned upon me that what I was hoping for when I was, or what I was expressing when I was crying, was a hope for rebirth, that somehow our visits felt like when she departed, it was a loss, and that I hadn't experienced a completeness to our relationship. And therefore, I had lost an opportunity to complete that because she was going. But this last visit was a real sense of connection with her in a way that felt complete. And therefore, I didn't feel a loss, and nor looking forward necessarily to the next visit, to that rebirth, when we could, you know, when we could finally come to some deep connection and come to a deep, satisfying mother-daughter relationship. And so it occurred to me that rebirth, the whole notion of rebirth in with respect to a lifetime, might be a sense that there's unfinished business in our lives. And we need to know, or we need to feel, that there's an opportunity to finish it, to complete it, to come to not necessarily closure, but to fulfillment, that somehow to come to the fullness of a relationship with, it could be with our daughter, with a friend, with our parents, with our animals. So that I thought, well, if it's possible for me to have experienced that fullness with her and not look forward to a rebirth in which a better situation could have, or a more fully realized situation could have occurred, then I wouldn't, I'd feel satisfied, you know, I'd feel that it was fulfilled. And so I asked myself, I wonder if one could lead a life which was sufficiently full and fulfilled such that rebirth really would be irrelevant. It wouldn't be something we'd need. And so I thought about Socrates, who I think felt when he drank the hemlock, his last words were to offer a sacrifice, which was typical in Greece at the time, to the god of healing, that his life, his death was a healing. And it was complete. He had led a complete life. As he said, the unexamined life is not living, is not worth living. So that was a kind of completeness. And there was no, quite independently of his own philosophy about the soul and the eternal soul, his actual death was a complete act. His life was a complete act. And there was, it was just fulfilled. And I also thought of Keith's Ode to a Nightingale, in which he says, "Now seems it rich to die, to hear the song of the nightingale." And it was as if the song of life was completed. And that was enough, you know? So rebirth has a could have a certain function for us in the longing to complete our lives in whatever way seems important to us, that there's unfinished business that a rebirth would help finish. So I think I don't want to go any further because I think I've talked enough. I just wanted to raise some of these lingering questions. And I think that that we have questions from you that are worth exploring as well. So thank you for listening. Hope you could follow it.
So I guess what we're going to do is invite folks that had shared questions with us to read their questions, and we're hoping that these start up conversations. So Marika, would you mind sharing?
Yeah, I guess that's my cue. okay. I had a hard time with this chapter as well. I felt like the words were bouncing off of me, and nothing was sinking in. Probably for a number of reasons, but regardless, I had trouble with this chapter. So, and I have trouble with the whole idea of rebirth and coming back. It does seem like a fairy tale to me. So the whole idea of rebirth that Mado brought up was part of my question. Everything was so specifically prescribed in here, like if you do this, then this, if you do this, then that. But so if a person, you know, does unwholesome or unrighteous act, thanks for filling that in a previous life, and that person comes back in a lowly, miserable station in life, won't this person forever be considered as having done wrongful deeds in the past life? And isn't it just a downward spiral from there because all these perceptions are already in place? So where does it all stop? You know, I don't know. That's pretty much it. I mean, the same thing happens in the education system and in, you know, lower socioeconomic stratas and the caste system. You know, it's really hard to jump those chasms to move ahead. And so once you do a bad deed, are you ever gonna is it even possible, given if karma and rebirth actually happens, is it possible to ever get back to good standing? So anyway, and the other question I had that's kind of different from this, actually very different, but whatever happened to not, celebrating not knowing? And why do we have to know what's supposed to happen? I mean, it seems kind of like, I agree with Mado. Well, it's like kind of a waste of time thinking about it because you should be just living. But anyway, it was a chapter we had, so thank you.
Chris?
Okay. Basically, this boils down to like literally what is reborn. Michael addressed that a little bit. I've thought about this, and I thought about karma. And I think for me, I also had a difficulty with this chapter and this concept. And for years, I've really not understood what is re if there's no self, what is reborn? What comes back? What did Buddha say comes back? And I haven't seen it, and I'm not aware of him saying it anywhere. However, my actions have a result, and they could easily have a result in the world that exists after I'm gone. In fact, they certainly will. Whether it's because of children or because of things I've done in the world that will extend after I'm dead. And if there is no, if there is, if there is, if there's no me and you, if there's no separation, then in the next world, after these five skandhas have been dispersed, my actions continue in a way and have an effect in a way, in a similar effect that they have in this world, in the sense that, yeah, these five skandhas are dispersed, but they're still around. And they're in different forms. And as far as me being reborn, I'm not 100% sure. I do understand that my karma might extend to the next world. How and who and what it affects, I'm still not clear. I understand after reading this chapter, I submitted the question before I really carefully read the chapter, that it is that it, for Buddha, I don't think this is a metaphor. I would love if anyone has more information. So if it isn't a metaphor, he meant it literally. And I really do not get what is born, what is reborn. So I guess that's all I have.
Tyson, right here.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to whoever seems to have edited the very long notes I sent to both you and Mado. So let's see here. As Mado talked about some, I was also unclear on how to understand this distinction between four kinds of karma in our first selection in the chapter. I expected there to be just three. There's bright karma, there's dark karma, and then there's a life where you have a mixture of the two. But then there shows up this fourth category, karma, that's neither dark nor bright. And I thought, what is this doing here? And like Mado, I found myself wondering, well, is there a way to substitute the words bright and dark for something else that might allow me to get a little bit of a foothold into the text and start working with some of that material? It didn't seem to me that good or bad fit really well, because bright karma isn't something that you want. It leads to a pleasant rebirth. But from the reading, the suggestion is that you want to have this karma that's neither bright nor dark, so you put an end to the cycle of rebirth. So now I'm even more confused as to what is going on with that cluster of issues. I also found the second text in the third part of the chapter interesting, which focuses on different reasons for giving. It seemed to me that what the Buddha offers in that text is an exhaustive list. These are all the general categories that if you are motivated to give, you would be motivated to give because of at least one of them, maybe two or three at the same time. But you couldn't be motivated to give for anything outside of that list, any reason outside of that list. And so a question I had, and maybe we can look at the text a little bit later, is could you think of a reason for giving that doesn't fit within one of those eight general categories? If not, that tells us something important about those reasons given by the Buddha, I think. In just the same way that we take the 10 grave precepts or the 10 clear mind precepts to be exhaustive, we don't think there's something that falls outside of them, or the eight worldly winds. Here we have an exhaustive list of eight reasons you might be motivated to give or be generous. And then, what did I write down here? Aha! I was inclined to quarrel with the final two sentences of the final text in our reading about insight being the most important thing above all other things. These last two sentences are, as great as all this might be, we have a long list of things that are supposedly spectacular, none of which includes my cat. It would be even more fruitful if one would develop a mind of loving kindness, even for the time it takes to pull a cow's udder. And as great as all this might be, it would even be more fruitful still if one would develop the perception of impermanence just for the time it takes to snap one's fingers. And at the risk of continuing to talk too much, I'll just say here that it's my understanding that both wisdom and compassion are important in our practice, the presence and something like a balance of both. And I take it that should be the message here too. Insight into emptiness, into impermanence is fantastic, let's say, but it shouldn't come at the expense of loving kindness in a way that one reading of this text suggests. So I wanted to offer some caution here, and encourage a more holistic approach, to understanding the importance of insight in the teachings. And I'll leave it there.
And Chodo Dave.
Thank you very much. Michael and Mado, thank you so much for the kind of overview of this chapter, which I'm hearing from people I've spoken with about it, really the sense of resistance and difficulty with this chapter. And I really appreciate the way you've talked about the chapter as something that is perhaps not really to be taken literally, but to be thought about metaphorically. And can we get more understanding of it coming at it from that perspective? But so I came at it literally with my question, in that the Buddha teaches that those whose volitional actions of body, speech, and mind produce bright karma. If they have righteous and meritorious ways with pure motives, they may be reborn in the human realm with positive and happy conditions such as wealth, influence, health, long life, and even good looks. And that was just kind of laughable, that part, that if you have been kind of an angry person in one sort of existence, or you've acted in an angry way, you're going to come back as good looking. So I'm really going to try to give up all the anger that I can, as soon as I can. But it led me to a couple of questions here. We live in a culture where being wealthy, being influential, having robust health, having good looks is looked up to. We revere people with that. And I was wondering, do somehow we think that people that have these attributes are somehow on the path, on the path towards awareness or enlightenment? There's a Yiddish expression that, I'm not Jewish, but I love this expression, and it says that if you're rich, people think you can sing too. And it just kind of made me question how the Buddha related certain types of behavior, certain actions, with a certain type of rebirth and quality of your life. And is there some reason that we look to people with these attributes and think maybe there's something special or something different about that person? And am I drawn to that? So the chapter made me think about that and try to understand that. I found it really challenging and a difficult chapter. So I really appreciate the conversation to this point. I have a much better understanding of it than I did before everybody made their presentations. So I thank you.
Mado, I saw on one of the slides that you had mentioned something about Koban, despite not knowing how to swim, how he wanted to save his daughter who had fallen into the lake. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, it's a question. I don't have any particular answer to it or even clear response, but in thinking about, in considering actions that are presumably karmically determinative, that they are actions which determine your rebirth or the consequences that flow from those. I wasn't there when Koban did, jumped into the pond, but I was just imagining what kind of action this was. My understanding is that it wasn't particularly volitional. I don't quite know what it was, but it was spontaneous. It was absolutely, my understanding is that it was immediate, that it wasn't a considered action. It wasn't, that's what I'm asking about. So are there actions which really don't as Taishin was asking about generosity, some things may not fit into that eight sequence. Similarly, is this an action that is really not subject to karma in the way that we have outlined karma or described it? That was it, who was jumping in there? Who was jumping in to save this young girl? Was it a deliberate, considered action? And what were the consequences? She died and he died. You know, what are we to say about an action like that? That's my question. Or have we ourselves experienced actions in a sort of mysterious category that don't really seem to be coming from our particular agency, that we didn't decide it? And the result was something that would typically be caused, would be judged to be unfortunate. How do we categorize actions relative to karma? That just seemed to be an action that is outside of the realm of karma. I don't know.
I'm still stumped on the karma being intentional acts. And of course, the first thing that pops in my head is, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. But it was really interesting to keep seeing this, even the right view. You've got a mundane right view and then a super mundane right view. And you've got this cycle of rebirth, death, rebirth. And yet there's an escape or a transcendence. Some of the difficulties I had with this, as I have with some of the previous chapters, is I guess this insertion of divinity or this trying to, this divine super mundane realm. It's almost like, I was a bit taken aback too by the neither bright nor dark karma and how this is going to absolve or get rid of karma. And I just, that, as far as the system goes, I'm really struggling to understand and interpret the system. Certain aspects of it, again, when viewed metaphorically, like rebirth and death, I understand. That seems to have a resonance with me. I understand the logic of it, but the it's my understanding that karma is life. It's not necessarily cause and effect. It's action, effect, 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 a bunch of billiard balls striking one another, moving back and forth. And it's almost, the way I'm interpreting this is that an intentional, neither dark nor bright karma is removing oneself and those acts from the equation to perhaps lessen the number of billiard balls on the pool table striking one another. I struggle to really understand that myself.
So I would ask this question. Why is it important to qualify karma? Why do we have to call it bright or dark? What's going on there? That's why I perhaps used Coben's action as, you know, it's neither bright nor dark. Why do we have to put that adjective on? Because we have a moral imperative. Somehow we have to have a moral, a law somehow, that it's not okay just to have things unfold without judgments. So this may be why, for example, Taishin mentioned the statement at the end that the insight into impermanence is best of all. Maybe because it is exactly that which eliminates good and bad. It just gets below the good and bad and just gets to the flow of life, impermanence, and all that flows from what flows out of that is not even karma. It's all the concepts are gone. So anyway, I think Susan had her palms together.
Yeah, me too.
Such a fruitful discussion from a chapter that we, many of us, just went at first. I'm really appreciating hearing everyone's ideas here. And what's coming to mind for me is the context. We're looking at, for fairy tales, if we're looking for context historically, and we take apart other sacred texts in this way from other traditions. Certainly I look at the Torah and wonder about some of these lists and numbers of how many cattle and so forth. So I'm looking at the context here and thinking that the polarities that we're seeing so much, the bright and the dark, and all of the different polarities we're looking at, maybe that's part of the context of the lives that of the people we were looking at here, who originally wrote down these ideas. What were their lives like? They really had survival issues. And they were really looking at the bright time of day and the dark time of night differently than we do in terms of their day-to-day lives. So I like to look at that as we gaze through the concepts and the taking the lists literally. And two thoughts came up. One is, I actually just read yesterday about Maggie Jackson's latest book called Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure. She's a journalist who looks at the edges of our decisions and the need to have tidy solution. And that's what we're looking at here. I think that the concept of rebirth is a very tidy solution to a whole bunch of questions. And it keeps people in place and it keeps people in a moral context that the leaders and the guiders of that culture can impose or can use as a way to keep order in the society or in the culture. But she is looking at the concept of uncertainty from a wide range as a journalist. She's, in a lot of contexts of work environment, she's looked at physics and science in terms of what happens when we're on the edge. And one of her best examples has to do with surgeons. Do you want a surgeon who is so sure of themselves and so right and so on it all the time? Or do you want a surgeon that can have what they call, oh dear, I'm not remembering the term, but it has to do with an expert who has flexibility or who can wing it. So there's humility in there. It's a word that comes up a lot in her writing. She's looking at uncertainty and the ability for someone to say, I don't know, it's beginner's mind. It's on the edge, putting oneself into a situation, often in a career or in, she's working a lot with corporate situations in which she wants people to learn how to disagree in a cordial manner, in a respectful manner, so that they're bringing up stuff that is hard to deal with, that puts them on edge, that puts them into a stress mode, because that's where learning occurs. So if we look at all our lists and all our fours of this and eights of that, that's a culture in which that edge is a little bit tricky, and we want to keep things tidied up. So I'm just going to finish with the idea that I certainly, Taishan, I certainly like your balance of insight and compassion, the heart-mind balance. And I would say that our author here on page 154 is giving real nod to those divine abodes, with love and kindness first, but looking at compassion, sympathetic, I call it sympathetic joy, and equanimity, and using that sense of karuna in balance with that sense of the insight of impermanence. So I'm going to leave it there.
Well, Bill, are you frozen? Looks like you're, oh, you have something to say? It looks like you're on mute and frozen. Oh, there you are.
There we go.
Hi there.
Hi, I'm here. I kind of follow up on Tova's first contextualization of the issue. This text, we can't imagine what the intellectual world, cultural world was in the 5th century BC. There weren't written texts. People were hearing things, but they weren't reading things. And if you didn't have the text, you depended on a few comments somewhere. And the notion of upaya comes up. If you're talking to fish, you can't talk to them about how good it is to breathe clean air. They don't live in that intellectual world. They don't experience the world in that way. I think this is where we miss a lot about universal standards, even Buddhism. They need to be viewed in context. Now, in India, the scholars, Buddhist scholars that come in the next few centuries, wrote the Abhidharma, or created the Abhidharma, which is the philosophical analysis of these concepts. And they had problems with birth, rebirth. In fact, as someone else has brought up already, in fact, I think it was you, Maido, you're born, you have a mission of thought, and it disappears. It's called kshinikavada, the instantaneousness of all experience. It's born, it persists for an instant and disappears. Now it seems to follow in the next instant, but that was somebody else's example. That was Michael's. That's the billiard ball effect of karma. Each instant is like a billiard ball hitting the next instant. And there's life and death in each one. So they were dealing with that issue as well. And furthermore, I think, well, I know I understand what I understand from the readings is that karma made sense to people in the world at that time because there wasn't any other argument. That was the undergirding understanding of the nature of the world. So the Buddha comes now, depending or anyone comes, how outside of that circle they are, how do you address people compassionately if you don't tell them, use the basic world assumptions that they're living with, cultural assumptions. And if you follow the next few chapters as well, what the Buddha does is, actually what the text does, says, you bring them to equanimity. And once they feel equanimity, equanimity, you remind them that that's impermanent too. So you go to the next level. And then everybody works hard and gets there. And then along comes the Buddha again. That's impermanent. It's not substantial. And he moves to the next level. So this concept of upaya has been incredibly used throughout history in Buddhism. And the classic story is from the Lotus Sutra. At first, I thought none of this existed in the Theravada tradition. And now I'm seeing it in the text we're reading that it does. But in the Lotus Sutra, there's the myth of the burning house. Now, you may be familiar with that. In the burning house, there's a wealthy family living in a wonderful mansion. And it's a father with his children. And they have wonderful toys. And but the father realizes foundations on this house are crumbling. If we don't get out of this house, we're in difficulty. But the kids are so involved in their toys, they can't imagine giving up their toys to go out. So he tells them a story. He says, "Outside, look outside the window. If we go out, there are three carts waiting out there." Why three? What the Mahayana called Hinayana, Mahayana, and then a final level above that. Each cart was a metaphor for later teachings that made use of the Supaya doctrine and took it beyond what people had been persuaded to believe in at one point. And this is where I have trouble with the notion of faith, which comes up in a lot of the texts. The term I like for Shraddha, which is the Sanskrit term, is confidence. You have confidence in your teacher that they're telling you what you need to know at the time you need to know it, and in the context that exists at that time. So I think there were both opinions in early India that these were metaphorical. Rebirth was a metaphorical concept. But Buddha certainly meant it as a literal fact because people also took that literally as well. There's another argument in particularly the Mahayana texts. When the Buddha speaks, everybody hears it within their own world of consciousness. And the Buddha is so consummate and his ability to perceive what people need. Each one hears it the way they need to. Now, that's a trick I'd like to have had as a teacher when I was teaching, but got a lot of flack for not having that skill. But I found the chapter, maybe because I'm interested in the history of Buddhism as well, enlightening. I found it, I was impressed by this chapter. I knew these things. I'd heard people summarize those things, but I never looked at it. And this is over the top. They really go to town with these lecherous scars and all of the bad stuff that's going to happen. And if you scratch that, and they really go over the top. For me, it was an informative chapter. And I think that's, we're coming up on the next chapter, which is just carrying this beat on. Chris and I will be coming next time. So I've already been thinking about this issue. And last week I read a quote by Robert Aiken about, we know it's a fiction. And knowing it's a fiction, we have complete faith in it. Wallace Stevens wrote that in one of his poems. And so I think it leads to effective action. So there's a causative quality there. Fiction leads to a positive, tentative result. Nothing is final. So what we're bothered about, one of the things that people are concerned about, the last thing I'll say, is Neither nor. Everything that we do, except the final level, is conditioned. Now, I think Maido is right. Some things you ask, well, how did that get conditioned? What brought that about? But every volitional action is conditioned. And maybe even some of the non-volitional actions as well. The only unconditioned action, the only way to break the hold of birth and death, is to achieve nirvana for this text, which cannot by definition be conditioned. It's the unconditioned result. So it's neither good karma nor bad karma when you arrive at that point. And how do I understand that? The way some people have been describing, Michael, it's the now. Once you're in the instant and you're not making a value judgment, you don't instinctively make a value judgment. It's neither good nor bad. You're responding at the time. And that's nirvana. But what the text also says, you have moments of these little insights. They last for a while, and then they're also all the way until you get very far. They drop away. In the end, when you die, maybe that's the new rebirth. But that's not so important. In Zen, it's been repeated in most Zen texts. You can't cause enlightenment. You can't decide, I'm going to do this, and therefore I'm going to be enlightened. I'm going to experience Satori. So the question is whether you know something and you practice something and you achieve wisdom, or you already have wisdom and you practice until something else happens, but you don't attain enlightenment because of something you do. If I'm wrong about that, please correct me, but that's what I've seen on a lot of texts and a lot of lectures by Zen teachers. So that's the neither nor, the number four category in Theravada, as I read it. I began reinterpreting a lot of the categories in terms of Mahayana concepts. And it's easy for us to do, but it gave a little more weight to them in my mind. And you're right, it doesn't communicate to people. Most people would not respond to this kind of teaching, except it's still very active in parts of the Buddhist world where they do take it literally. So those are a few comments, more to follow.
Thanks so much, Phil.
Oh, I can say one more thing. There's a great Jewish story about a Reb that travels around various parts of Eastern Europe. And he comes into villages where people don't know him. And his attendant says to him, you always get the meals and people treat you so well when you go into a village. And all I do is put the horses away and take the baggage. So the teacher says to his assistant, look, this is a village where no one has seen us in generations. So you're me when we go in. And I'll be you. I'll be the attendant. And so they go in. First question that comes up is an impossible question. But the attendant is really smart. He says to the actual teacher, he doesn't say to his teacher, he says to the group, why, you foolish rural barbarians, how ignorant you are. Why, even my assistant could answer this question. And the same guy is called upon to make a decision about a cow that's eating goats that are getting into somebody else's yard and eating the grass. And so the Reb comes in, and they make decisions about who's right and who's wrong. So these two farmers come to him, and they say, my goat got away, and my neighbor's keeping him, and I can't get him back. And the neighbor said, well, he ate all my vegetables, so he owes me. So the first time he says, I want my goat back, the Reb says, yeah, you're right. Second guy says, but he ate all my vegetables. Yeah, you're right too. And the first guy says, we can't both be right. And the ref says, yeah, you're right. Neither nor.
Thanks so much.
We have a, Bill, thank you very much. We have a few minutes left before we wrap up for the evening, and we have a few people that have not yet had a chance to offer a reflection or a question or a thought on the chapter. So if you have something that you'd like to say, now would be a good time to say it. Jero, anything to add?
Oh, I had just, I appreciated the one small part, which was discussed under meditation. And it was interesting to me that the whole focus was being compassionate, in compassionate spirit. And it didn't say anything in the meditation part about shikantaza or just sit. So I thought it was kind of delightful that here we are studying the Buddha's words, but we don't seem to get anything that says just sit.
Emmy, did you want to say something? You're on mute.
And it looks like you're frozen.
Hi. Oh, am I? Can you hear me?
No, yeah, we can hear you now.
Hello, everybody, and thank you. And I'm one of those rare people, I guess, tonight that liked the chapter very much. Surprisingly, I'm surprised. But I'll just say that I liked a lot of what he said. Well, what Jero said about, to me, it comes down to loving kindness. And in the introduction, he did point out the wholesome and the unwholesome. And I got a kick out of reading a lot about the unwholesome, believe it or not, just because there are people like that. There are people that are selfish and delusional and full of hatred, and you know what, it was kind of liberating to me. If they want to be that way, well, that's the way they're going to be. And so anyway, that's the way I took it. And then he did point back at the Eightfold Path and the right view and the right way of living. So I appreciated that a lot. And then there was one more thing. Oh, the other thing that struck me was that he did say that this, of course, it doesn't happen over one lifetime. It's many lifetimes. And, you know, it takes an understanding of the relationship with the world in this way to understand the karma, I think. So that's the way I took it. Thank you.
So I think Jackie had her palms together for quite a while, and I'd like to hear from her if we have some time.
Thank you, Mado. I just, I was very glad to hear what Bill was saying, because my thoughts were questions in that area where it felt to me like, was the Buddha speaking in the language and the customs of the day so that people could understand it? Because as I vaguely know, karma and so on is part of Hinduism, right, as well. And did the people of that day already have these beliefs about the different levels of life, that different levels that you could get reborn into? And I also wondered about this very analytical structure of there's eight of this, and within these eight, there's three other things within each one, and then we can invert it. And on the other side, we get the mirror image is very, very structured and analytical. And I had a couple thoughts, questions just about that. One is, did that just make it easier for people to remember because they're not reading, they are transmitting this orally? And the other question was this also part of the Indian culture where the philosophy was extremely analytical at that time? And so this was something that people would react to. And my other idea was, if the Buddha was saying all these things today in our context, what would he be saying? You know, because we don't have in our culture already rebirth and all of these concepts that we're having trouble with, and karma playing into all these rebirth things. And my last thought was, it feels like Calvinism, it feels like predestination, that you know, if you're having a good life right now, that shows that you must have had good karma to have this good life. And that reminded me of Calvinistic beliefs that the elect, you know, that you're special because you're good, your business is successful, and you know. So these were just some thoughts that I had, and I would like to know more about the context of the society in which all these things are arising in the Pali canon, and I really would like to think about if it was context dependent how the Buddha is presenting these ideas. If he was alive now presenting these ideas, what would they be like? That's it. These were just things that came up for me. So thank you.
I think the hour has come, and rather than continue the question and answer, we all have a lot to think about for the next week. It's been a very rich and helpful conversation, and grateful to all of you for helping unpack this chapter, which was challenging. So really appreciate Mado and Michael, you're taking the lead, and everybody's contributions to the conversation. Just wanted to confirm our plans for next week. We'll actually be covering two chapters, chapters 6 and 7. And Bill, as he mentioned, and Tetsuo will be covering chapter 6, Deepening One's Perspective on the World. And then we will also be covering chapter 7, The Path of Liberation, with Juliana and Ekudo. So thanking you in advance for leading next week's conversation. And I think, as is our tradition here, we will, I'll turn it over to my partner, who will ask somebody to lead the three refuges. So Mariko?
Do we have somebody that would like to lead it? Ekudo-san?
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.